Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. This is Scout Talk, and today I have a special guest, and that's Dan Hatman, the founder of the Scouting Academy, which is just a terrific resource for anybody out there who is, you know, an aspiring analyst, you know, for the draft, or someone who wants to learn more about the game on a deeper level. Really on one of the deepest levels. And then also, of course, based on the name of the company as well, for those who are interested in becoming NFL and scouts and college, college recruiters, people who are involved in the scouting of talent. And Dan has certainly done an excellent job of being able to start up a company that has placed people in the NFL, in scouting positions, and has made quite a mark. And I'm going to share this, Dan. And first, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, I am always happy to be here. I love talking shop with you.
Yeah, I mean, this is always fun. And one of the stories I do want to tell is that, this is something that's a little bit more inside baseball, but I think it's valuable to people who are interested in this type of work. And it's, there was a time that I had heard, I know that, probably while you were either, playing college football or actually scouting for, the Giants or Eagles at that time, I remember, and before you were doing the Scouting Academy, I just remember hearing that, if you were someone that there was a certain way of networking with teams to try and become a scout. And one of those ways not to do it was to do certain things like in terms of, really doing some of the more traditional networking types of things that you might do in corporate America. and that what would happen is that if you did some of those things, that teams kind of had like a kind of an unofficial black book that they put you on a blacklist and said, if we ever get anything or see this person again, just ignore them because we don't want anything to do with them. So, I'd hear people tell me stories about how they, I sent my scouting guide to, some teams, and that may have worked for Chad Ryder, who's who works at NFL.com back in like the early 90s when teams didn't get bombarded with this information. But once his story probably came out, there were probably about a dozen to two dozen people who started doing that. And teams were like, yeah, let's put you on a shelf somewhere and write your name in a little book. And so I remember being at the Senior Bowl, and and there were people who I remember talking kind of about, kind of circumspect when the Scouting Academy got started, because there were guys who remembered these types of stories, and they saw a lot of your pupils kind of going around and networking with people and talking with scouts on a certain level sharing about some of the things they had conversations about. And I remember being told, they're like, I don't know how that's going to work out, because this is what's happened at least in the recent past. And they shared a story about somebody who was like, who had talked specifically about what he used to do with these types of situations, who was someone high up in personnel with an NFL team. And it turned out a year later, that exact person with that NFL team came and spoke to your class at the Scouting Academy and was a convert of what you were doing, of what you were doing, and had hired someone on staff, and unbeknownst to him, he didn't know that they had gone through the Scouting Academy until after he hired that individual. And then he was really impressed with the more that he dug in and got a chance to speak with that individual and speak with you. And then he ended up speaking in front of one of your classes that following year at the Senior Bowl. So if that's not a good testament to, the quality of work that Dan, you're doing over at the Scouting Academy, I really don't know what is, especially concerning what the environment was.
It's a rough industry because we all live in such anecdotal worlds of like our background, our history, how we did it, or even how our organization does it. And I mean, we still fight this battle to this day in terms of the one size fits all advice people get. Do this, don't do this. And it's not how this little industry works. It's only a couple hundred people. Anybody that's come to Mobile and sat in Ladd People Stadium and looked around and said, like, this is it. This is the entirety of the NFL. It's not that many people. And so it's really become about customizing to situation, you know, different backgrounds, different skill sets, different regions, different networks, different ages, and then trying to find ways for people to highlight the things that they've done and maximize those opportunities. And I think I know which person you're talking about there, but you know, and I don't sit here and try to act like we have every exec with every team that's a convert. There's still some that that fight against any sort of like prep or training or whatever else. And they, you know, they just want people to come in and do the same kind of, we're going to stick you in a closet and give you a bunch of work that you don't know how to do. And if you survive that, then you're competent. But it's just not the way I enjoyed operating. I didn't enjoy being put in those situations. I think most of us would like to be ready to go be a high level executor as early as possible. And so we get excited to help people do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because I remember, I mean, I just remember thinking that the idea of the stories I heard included things like, well, you know, how'd you get your job? Well, I was sitting outside a doorway, you know, at the NFL Combine at these meetings, and I was a, you know, and I was a quarterback for, and I don't even know whether you told me this story or somebody else did, but it was like, there's a guy who was like a former high school quarterback who knew the GM because they played each other in high school. And he had done all this work, and he sat out there and saw him and said hello, and then kind of just said, you know, I'd like to talk with you about maybe doing some work in the scouting realm. And the guy's like, well, you know, if you want to talk with me, I'm going to be in a meeting for the next several hours, but wait here. And literally they were in a meeting for most of the day. He didn't come out. And when he did kind of come out at the end of the day, the guy was still sitting there, you know? So at that point he was like, okay, you know, let's have a meet, you know, have a chat. And they had like a 15, 20 minute chat, and then, you know, didn't hear from the, you know, and the guy went back to his, you know, went back home to wherever he was from. And, you know, it was like months and months later before he even heard from the guy, and, you know, from the personnel manager. And it was, and then they had another interview, and, you know, it was just kind of this very old school idea of let me see how dedicated you are to the idea of doing this, as opposed to let's just kind of go through some fairly normal hiring measures about how we could go, you know, do things. It almost kind of felt like the way you hear stories about, you know, old time Hollywood or act, you know, any kind of performance world where, you know, where you hear about studios or agents or management or other artists treating people with a level of, I wouldn't necessarily say disrespect, but maybe just disregard. And then they want to see if the person who wants the job really wants it, you know. so there's a kind of power play going on that I find kind of interesting, you know, in terms of how that works. But it sounds like that with what you guys are doing, it's kind of also helping to manage upward in a way that will help people understand not only the value that, you know, the decision makers kind of see the value that they can get out of a program like yours. And as a result of that, that it also kind of helps them kind of have a new way about going about the process.
that's the hope. You know, we just want to make a positive impact. If we figure if we're doing right by the organizations and the people involved, it'll have that positive impact, and that'll allow us to stay around and help people.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, the combine. You know, one player who came up this week that I know I've liked a lot, you know, in terms of watching his tape early on, and we had a conversation about offline and you were there, was Quintez Cephas, the wide receiver out of Wisconsin, who had quite a career because, you know, he came onto the scene pretty early in 2017. I believe that was his freshman year. I think was his freshman year at this point. I know that when he began at Wisconsin, he ended up leading the team and leading the Big Ten, I believe, in yards per catch. So he established himself as a guy who certainly could generate big plays in the passing game, whether it was after the catch or being able to get separation on defenders or be able to stretch zones. And he certainly tracks the ball very well. At the end of 2017, he broke his leg and had surgery on his leg. And then he ended up getting expelled from school because he was charged with two counts of rape. I'm not going to give the complete story, but the basic story, then there are important details with it that you can read certainly, like, say, at SI.com or any Wisconsin local, you know, newspaper that's covered the story. But he went to a party. He met two women. The two women were drinking. They were all drinking, I'm sure. And then they asked for a ride back to his place. They both, you know, according to Cephas, they both proceeded to undress and basically invite him for a sleepover. And they had sex. They consented, according to him. They claimed that they were too drunk to be able to consent. But there were apparently, when the trial came out and they had the trial, there were witnesses that corroborated, you know, I think a roommate, and there were others that corroborated Cephas' story. And the jury pretty much acquitted him on both counts in pretty short order. But Cephas got expelled because he was, how would we best put it? He didn't share everything. He didn't want to share everything with Wisconsin. They asked him certain questions, and he went and got an attorney right away, noting the seriousness of the charge. And Wisconsin right away decided that if he wasn't going to comply with interviewing with them, that they considered him guilty in their eyes and expelled him. And then he sued the school because that violated Title IX. And as a result of this, he missed 15 months of time with the school and dealing with the trial. And then when he was acquitted, he requested to re-enroll, and they re-enrolled him a year and a half later, almost a year and a half later, in August of 2019. And then he played, you know, he started playing about a month later. And so that's his story in terms of what's gone on with his career. He had a very strong, you know, final year at Wisconsin. And then he proceeded to come to the combine as a sleeper prospect, you know, at about 6'1", 207, very strong. He put up 23 reps on the bench press, which led all wide receivers. He had, you know, looking at what some of the results of his combine, he had also a, you know, 4.33 second 20 shuttle, which I know, depending on how you look at the ranges, I see that as a pretty good time. 7.2 three cone drill, which is adequate, I think. And then he had a vertical leap of 38.5 inches. But the big number that you know, seemed to really catch up with him is that he ran a 4.73 40, which is a reserve level time at best, depending on how people look at that. So, you know, a lot of people said that he didn't start very strong, that his running form wasn't very strong. And what I wonder with this long lead up to kind of give you an idea about Cephas is, you know, when you see a player who has a slow time, but you look at his film and you see him separating against people, you know, on a regular basis, being able to get deep or to be able to win, you know, in the deep and intermediate range, having a high yards per reception, and then having guys like Jeffrey Okuda and Will Arnett both say when asked who was the toughest receiver you faced, and they've faced some pretty good competition throughout the years. And then one name that came up to them was, and the first name was Quintez Cephas. So, you know, when you think about, you know, what he's done at the combine and where, you know, the different information, how do you determine whether or not that 4.73 was an aberration or whether that's closer to the, or that's actually the truth of the matter in terms of his actual speed?
So I'm a big believer in trust but verify. My stepfather was a big time woodworker, so the old, you know, measure twice, cut once. I think all of it boils down into the scientific method, right? We have a hypothesis and then we go test it. And so going into the combine, I don't think anybody expected him to run like Henry Ruggs was going to run. But again, to your point, I don't think anybody expected him to run that slow. So it doesn't add up. Everybody's going to estimate early. I mean, that's why they were able to put betting lines out on the 40 time ahead of time, is that people can estimate these things to a close enough degree that it becomes reasonable for people to get involved in that kind of stuff. So when you see an expectation not met, to me, that just means further inquiry. And instead of just looking at the time, I actually want to watch how he runs. And if we start seeing a player who is, again, immediately coming up, anybody that's looked at the form of someone who's going to be a sprinter understands the idea of forward lean. And, you know, anybody that's ever been out and seen a boat with a sail up, if you expose the entirety of your chest, you know, you basically become that sail. And, you know, the aerodynamics don't exactly help you in that way. So if you start seeing bad form, that can be a huge detriment to the overall time. I don't think it's going to take him down to a 4.39 prospect, but can certainly impact that time. And so one of the things that I would want to look at is what I remember hearing years ago, and when people would reference Jerry Rice's 40 time, which you know, wasn't impressive coming out, was the flying 20. So the last 20 yards of the 40 after the acceleration point. And one of the arguments made about a guy like Jerry Rice is his flying 20 was up there with everybody else's because he had that stamina. You know, he worked his tail off. So he was always in good enough shape that he could maintain his speed for longer than other people. It wasn't a short duration. He could maintain his speed for a long duration. So one of the things I would want to do is take a look at that flying 20, which is, to me, take the 40, subtract the initial 20 yard, get that last bit, and then compare that to the rest of the population to see, hey, where did his flying 20 measure up with other receivers? And if I start to see a profile where his flying 20 was actually up with the guys running closer to 4.5, and we look at the form and the form's bad, then now I'm starting to generate a new hypothesis that he might be technically deficient in how he ran it, which starts to generate questions on his preparation. Did he have a good agent? Does the agent have him in a good training facility? Does he know what to do? Because if all those things start to add up and he just didn't do it, that could be a red flag, again, for further exploration. But if it turns out that he's just back with his, you know, his buddies running him on a local high school field, or things of that nature, that could start to send that up. Now, chances are he's got an agent, and that agent is not enjoying the narrative right now with that 40 time. So I'm going to guess that between now and his pro day, there's going to be a whole lot of 40s run with a speed coach. They're probably going to get their hands on one of those. And so I'll be fascinated to see what he runs at his pro day. And besides, again, just looking at the time, I want to look at the form. I want to look at, again, that flying 20 or last 20 and start to see, is this something that, again, is screaming of a technical deficiency in this? To me, that's a different story than an athletic one. Again, an athletic deficiency The ability to improve that over time is just lesser than technical. No one's born with technique, so we all learn that at some point. So whenever I get done with finding an outcome that's unpleasant in this, I'm always asking the question of, is it mental, physical, technical, or a combination therein? Because that informs to me the potential upside of improving that negative outcome.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I love the detail that you shared there, especially about the flying 20. It would be nice if that was the if they were able to share times publicly about some of the different splits. Sometimes you see that with some, you know, from some sources, but it's not like, you know, you can go to say, you know, and you know, combineresults.com, which is NFLcombineresults.com, which is a site that does a good job of recording a lot of different things. But they, you know, they'll try to share things like the 20-yard split, the 10-yard split, you know, and, you know, looking at Quintez Cephas's results. One of the questions I do have for you, though, is also about, say, the explosion areas of his game, like the, some of the, you know, the measurables that they did record. He had a 38.5 vertical. He had a 124-inch broad jump. You know, from a vertical standpoint, you know, this is very, the way I'm looking at this is very, you know, I'm probably risking overfitting the data. I would even just say I'm overfitting the data most likely. But going back to look at guys who leapt, who were able to leap at least 38.5 inches since, say, 2006, you know, I found six names who basically leaped 38.5 inches and ran slower than a 4.59 out of, you know, a lot more, you know, well over 100 players who were, you know, who qualified in those, in that area of a 38.5 inch leap. And so I found it interesting. And the guys that were mentioned, there were only really two who were outside receivers. And those were Devin Funchess. And I'm trying to remember the other guy that I had mentioned in the past. But, you know, I think it was, you know, Ryan Whalen, Devin Funchess, Ronnell Hall. And I'm trying to remember who the other guy was that was of consequence on that list. But the point being is that, you know, usually you'd see guys run in the mid 4.5s who had that type of explosion to be able to leap upward that high. You know, and I would think that the vertical and the broad are two ways that kind of give you a sense of what their natural get off is in terms of their first, you know, that first step quickness, that first, you know, step either changing direction or being able to really be able to begin their acceleration phase. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Oh, I think it's an incredibly valid point. You know, these days we're going to weight adjust those kind of those numbers. So you get a guy that weighed in, I think it was, what, 202 pounds. And you said it was 38.5 and it was 124. You know, those are good numbers at that weight. I mean, those are very good numbers at that weight. I think they're close to 75 or 80th percentile for all wide receivers, regardless of weight. So to have those at that size is a good sign. And again, it just doesn't add up. Most of the time, those guys that have those explosion numbers, when you talk about that linear plane with the vertical and the broad, those same, the same muscle fibers, the same systems that allow you to generate that often allow you to generate a considerable portion of your speed. And so, no, we would expect the number to be, you know, closer to a 4.55 than we would a 4.73. Now, that's a different profile than the shuttles and those kind of things. Again, different athletic profiles and parts of the movement pattern. But yeah, when you start to see those explosion numbers at that weight, to see him come in where he did, it's just not adding up. 2 and 2 is not equaling 4 in the same way that you would expect it to.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's just it's an interesting thing. And I think that kind of bleeds into the next part of, you know, the question, you know, or conversation I wanted to have with you today, which is, you know, we were talking a while back about, you know, that football, especially when it comes to the analysis of the game, I mean, it's kind of like academic silos, the more that I look at this. And I think that as someone who, you know, worked at a business school for 10 years and covered what professors did, you know, you had these different disciplines, you know, you had finance and economics and real estate and accounting, and they're all, you know, there are things where you could see how things bled together from an academic research standpoint, but, you know, most people stuck to research on a very small, you know, area of, you know, because research is very much about having to be a very specific subject. So it was very rare that you'd have someone who did interdisciplinary research and did it at a really high level. And most of the time you'd have to partner up with someone of a different, you know, from a different area. And, but as a result, you kind of unintentionally get this kind of siloed thinking about things where, you know, you don't, maybe there's times that it would be more beneficial to consider a wider, you know, range of information than what you may be capable of being able to do. And when I look at, you know, the analysis, at least in the public sphere, what I see is, you know, you have people who do the strategic analysis, looking at the X's and O's, and they're great at being able to break down, you know, coverages and what the blocking scheme is and what's, you know, and how the play is supposed to work. And in theory, what each player is supposed to do on a strategic level, just in terms of, and I don't even know if I'd say strategic is the exact word, because also being strategic is understanding when things don't go the way they're supposed to, and, you know, and seeing if they, and understanding the perspective that maybe a player has on being able to adjust. But then you have that, you have the more analytic realm, which is, you know, which can range from, you know, a silo of what, you know, what's the best type of calls to make or not to make given down a distance situations or red zone situations, and to, you know, go for it or not go for it, you know, to go for 2 points or to go for the field goal, things like that, as well as the whole analytical look of what makes up a, you know, what makes a good prospect, you know, which is kind of a whole other area, if you ask me, in terms of, you know, for that. And then you have, you know, people who are scouting the game. And I think that when you look at scouting the game, you also have a sense of, you know, where the analytical is based on trying to be as scientific as possible in terms of, you know, it's desires to try and make it as black and white as possible. And I think that there's an element of that with scouting where you try and go about it in a scientific way. We just had that conversation in terms of the methodology you would try to do to problem solve a question about a guy like Quintez Cephas. You know, there's also a point where scouting is a very interdisciplinary type of work, because while there are certainly people out there who scout the game who may not have the expertise of the best X's and O's people and may not be as, you know, on the level of some, you know, stats people with master's degrees or PhDs, you know, they're incorporating multiple elements into the examination of a player so that they can understand how that player performs and the types of decisions that they make. But it seems like that's also, you know, in a way that's also very literary, that you're looking at things simply in a black and white way, but you're trying to incorporate different things that have a black and white perspective, but, you know, incorporating them together in the same way that you might analyze a piece of literature, for instance. You know, it's like if you study literature, there's times that you may incorporate things that talk about scientific concepts or philosophical concepts or even, you know, psychological things and talk about how, you know, maybe a certain pattern of imagery has a certain psychological effect on the reader. And you could even cite psychological studies that talk about, say, you know, the alternating imagery of black and white, which is called the chiaroscuro effect, for instance. William Faulkner used that in one of his books to start a scene that was to create a psychological effect on the reader overall in terms of how he built that scene. So, you know, all of that to just kind of wonder, you know, you obviously have spent years now working with people who want to learn how to develop this game, who are to learn how to scout this game. And, you know, they come from a variety of backgrounds, whether they've played, they've coached, they've, you know, they're doing analytics. What are your thoughts about, you know, this subject in terms of how players or how people are, how the value is of looking at things in both a black and white perspective and a more scientific perspective, as well as looking at it from a literary perspective?
So I have this mechanism that we built into the class that when people finish their first module, we talk about this. So we'll pull back the curtain a little bit and get into it here. So I like to define what it is that we view scouting as from our standpoint, because football in general really suffers from poor definitions. And I look no farther than the word good. Think about everybody that you've interacted with or heard from or learned from in football and how often they've used the adjective good. And then think about that same cluster of people, picture putting them in a room and asking them to write down their definition of the word good. And then imagine how many of those definitions match.
Yep.
Yeah, probably none, right?
Right.
So
right.
To me, that means we arbitrarily allow every single person involved in this to make up whatever the hell it is that they mean by whatever the hell they say. And it creates no accountability, no ability to research, no ability to develop, because you can constantly cover your ass by going, well, he does it sometimes. Like the vitriol I have over sometimes, at times, and inconsistent is probably just not rational at this point, because sometimes could be 99% of the time or 1% of the time. It's the world's biggest crutch for scouting. The fact that we allow it to live is a detriment to our industry, because you can't possibly communicate an expectation with sometimes. Because if I said, hey, I got this receiver, man, he gets open sometimes. I haven't communicated anything. I've given you an opportunity to interpret that however you want. You will develop a mental picture, but it has nothing to do with what I saw.
Right.
And I see that as an issue. So anyway, and for the purposes of working through definitions, I'm a big proponent of defining what does it mean to be a scout. And the first one to me of two kind of components to this is where we've heard a phrase pretty often, get the player right. And we got to get the player right. And there's other ways to say that, but I think it's the most common. But again, what's the definition of that? Who's posting this operating definition of getting the player right? So let's take any college prospect that anybody's talking about right now. And we are leveraging their past performance and historical data on them to predict the future. Like really what we talk about this process, yeah, we watched how you played in the 2019 season, but we absolutely do not care how you played in 2019. What we care about is whether or not that predicts your performance at the next level for an individual team. And so we do all this research on the past, but again, the ability to take that, not just go out and accumulate disparate, accurate information on various components of this human being's history, but then to integrate them in a way that allows you to see the future is a pretty nuanced task. And then not only do we have to come up with our own interpretation of this prediction of the future of this human being, but this human being is then going to go to a new city with a new team, with a new coaching staff and a new set of philosophies and a new play caller and a new position coach and a new locker room and a new compensation structure. And we have to predict this human being's performance through all of those lenses. And then not only that, But until you are the final decision maker, you have to hand off that finding to another human being. I don't care if this is media analysis or for a team. We're always handing off our work to somebody else who is the end consumer of it. And then they have to get our vision, not their vision, our vision, if we're communicating. And so to answer your question, like to come back to this idea of being able to take and set out in the world to accurately gather all of this disparate information on a human being, which can be data-oriented, which can be subjectively collected, which is personality-driven in many situations, which takes a depth of knowledge of that institution's practices to try to contextualize outcomes, and then again, to integrate all of that. No, I don't feel convinced with all my experiences in this that everybody engaged in it can do all parts of that well.
Right.
And so we're talking about a really unique generalist. I actually kind of came across this term. I mean, I'd heard it, but I came across this term because I had done this mechanism of trying to price out what a scout should be paid. And in looking at all the disparate job functions, it brought me to this term of human resources generalist or human resources director, like at a corporate level. And using Glassdoor, I was trying to figure out like what would that cost. And anyway, and it kind of just
wait. Are you telling me that we're like the Tobys of this sphere? Because
that is not the comp that I want to roll with on that one. But when I listed out the job functions and like tried to compare that to industry to find a comp, it was a little scary, a little unnerving, to say the least. So for all of you about to come at me with that, I get it. I got to take that one.
Okay.
But yeah, it was this idea of like you're gonna be a lot of things, and you would be a lot of things at a high enough level to understand the difference between signal and noise, understand the difference between good information and bad information, and figure out when you have to call the limits on what you've learned and what you can do with it. It's a lot. It's a lot to be able to do. And so, you know, if you can find those people, and I don't know if it's necessarily as rare as like a unicorn, but if you can find those people, obviously accumulating them seems like a valid strategy. But I could also see like if you have one or two people who are amazing at integrating, and then you hire a bunch of specialists who are elite in the different verticals, that sounds like it could be an effective strategy. But someone at the very, very top better understand everybody's skill sets, which means maybe does ownership need to be good at all this? And then we're getting into a whole different conversation.
Right. And it always seems to lead back to ownership when it comes to the evaluation of personnel and pulling the trigger and making decisions. But yeah, it is fascinating. I think that's an interesting response or a good response. I don't know, good, right? But it's a response that really gives us a lot of detail because it's, you know, just the conversation we had about CFIS, you know, there are going to be some people who just look at the number and say, well, he doesn't match what needs to happen, you know, and then you have people who want to investigate it further, but may not understand the tools about going about doing that. And being able to see that there is a little bit more craft to that, you know, that you can look at a variety of different data points to determine that. But then in addition to that, you still need to look at the subjective area of it, or just the thing that has to do with outside of the numbers, which is who did he train with? Did he train with anybody? Who's he working with as an agent? Where does he work out? Then there's the aspect of we could twist, you know, turn this into a different thing and say, hypothetically, what if it was at CFIS, you know, that the situation with CFIS was that he had been out of school for the past year and a half and got invited to the combine, but hadn't been playing at Wisconsin this entire year, and he ran a 4.73. And then you'd say, you know, and maybe it was, and he had missed a year and a half, and then you could start asking questions about things like how much time did he have in a weight room or in a good facility? Because one of the things that we, you know, I know that Russ Landy and I talked about, you know, a couple of weeks ago on a recent Scout Talk podcast was the idea that, you know, look at some of the HBCU schools or some of the other smaller programs out there that may not have the facilities of, say, a Wisconsin or an Alabama or LSU, and, you know, or even say a Penn State, where, say, you know, Saquon Barkley entered school as a, you know, as a much smaller human being, you know, 40 pounds less, and ran a 4.66 40 and jumped, I think, what, like a 34 vertical leap. And, you know, and I know that his 20 wasn't anywhere near what his 20 was at the combine, but then he turned into basically a 4.4 or 4.39 40, and, you know, added about 6 inches to his vertical leap and added about 40 pounds to his frame. And, you know, that ability to add the explosive, you know, the explosion to your frame is important. So, you know, say a guy like Cephas had missed a year and a half of time to train, that would be an element that you might look into. I mean, certainly you even look at a guy like Ray Rice from way back in the day. And I remember having a conversation with Greg Cosell about this, you know, just offline, and I asked him what he thought about Ray Rice, and it was Ray's first year. And he said he really liked him out of school, but he thought he was, you know, wasn't quick enough that first year. He just didn't look quick enough. And some of that could be about absorbing the offense and acclimating to the scheme. Some of it also could have been that he didn't have that explosive strength and that, you know, that quick twitch explosion built up to the level that his body was capable of being able to do, because he added about 10, 15 pounds of muscle. And, you know, at least I remember going back and asking Greg what he thought a year later, and he said he looked a lot quicker from what he noticed, you know, and maybe, you know, there's that whole idea of being able to, you know, add later. So it, you know, looking at all those different moving parts is a, you know, does take a lot. It does take a lot of skill. And I think that you're right to say that, or you have a good idea there to talk about, let's get some specialists in there and then have some people who are very skilled from a generalist perspective who can kind of ferret out that information and pull the trigger. And the important part there, though, is having somebody in charge who can manage these, you know, different people and give them a very clear vision of what their role is and how what the other people's roles are and how they interact, so that they buy into it and work together in a very cohesive way, so that they can get the most information they can about a player and in a way that you know, allows that person to be able to make good decisions to see what the story is on that player.
It's, and this is a piece that is kind of been an interesting part. Like, if you were to build a single scouting staff, and again, optimizing in that way and how to go about it. I mean, maybe the number of high level generalists is enough that within the marketplace, even with other teams, you know, hiring people, that you could still put together 18 to 20 people, which is about the average size of a scouting staff. You can still find 18 to 20 high level generalists in all this that, again, like this work, understanding of the compensation, the hours are probably not going to match up to private industry and things of that nature. You know, when we talk about, like, we were talking about receiver before, and one of my favorite discussion points about receiver, people get into, okay, well, he's got X skill set, and let's say it's not Julio Jones, it doesn't cover all the bases, and well, he only, you know, he has this role or has this type of skill set, and well, how do you value that? Well, ultimately, we're not, on the team side, you're not doing it in a vacuum. Like, his value is based on what you currently have under contract, what's in your building. And so one of my favorite adages was, like, a receiver room ends up being more like a basketball team. And inside of that, you'd like to have different body types and skill sets so that the entirety of the room covers all the bases that you feel like need to be covered. Certainly, if you can go get 5 Calvin Johnsons, like, amen, more power to you. But I mean, come on, that's not happening. So
you know, play the lottery if that happens. Yeah,
you're right. I mean, my goodness. Yeah. Detroit was trying for a little while, but when you know, you're not going to look at a room and say, you know, I want 5 Devin Duvernays in one room.
Right.
You know, and at the same time, I'm just going to, you know, because University of Texas is clearing my head, where you don't want 5 Colin Johnson's on the same roster. You know, you'd like those things to balance each other. So, you know, you want a big man, you want someone that can move the sticks, work on option routes, work in some of the underneath areas. Maybe you want some swing players that can, you know, have a mid-level body type, do some outside inside things. Like, you start to put all that together. And so that kind of metaphor I've brought over when I look at a personnel shop of how you're structuring this, like, again, is the expectation that you're going to take someone who hasn't proven that they have high level generalist and that they'll learn it through osmosis over time? Or would you go about it and say, hey, you know, this staff member covers this base. You know, we have an alum, Kathleen, works for the Senior Bowl, and her background prior to pursuing a career in football was in private investigation through like a corporate side of things. And so she has a ton of history and strategy and technique and skill set in interviewing and behavioral interviewing and research and investigating and digging on things. Like, so when she's been trying to find an NFL job, we've like written a job description that would highlight that and could supplement everybody else on staff, not replace. But if you have an individual that says, hey, I've maxed out what my sources have at this school, like what's next steps would you take? Wouldn't it be nice to have someone on staff that is an expert in that area and can fill right. at least have a pool of consultants available? And so one of the things I hope to see the industry do is get away from the expectation of like, you know, you're in, you're perfect, you've got everything, just do it, into, hey, you might come back and of the 20 things we need you to have collected, you might only feel like 18 of them do you have accurate information on, and you need support in these other two. Like, okay, I hear you. Let's go out and put together what we need to do to get you that support to fill in those blanks and allow the entirety of the team to get the player right, as opposed to the expectation that maybe one human being is going to be this this perfect integrator of all the information that they themselves had to go collect and synthesize all by themselves.
Yeah, it's like a legal firm or an accounting firm. I mean, you know, if you have a case, you're not going to have, you know, when you look at these big cases that are in the media, they usually have a legal team of, you know, 4 to 5 people, and each of them have specialties in terms of what they're really good at and skilled at, so that you can help your client get the best defense or you know, possible. And same with the prosecution team or an accounting team that's going to, you know, you might have someone who's really good at forensic accounting. You might have someone who's good at another area of the discipline, you know, so that you're getting a well-rounded view of the topic or situation. So, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And it also, you know, just kind of underscores the opportunities that the NFL still has in terms of, you know, this sport that was, you know, that has evolved so much over 100 years, and a lot of the processes or things that were done, they were born out of this game, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have matured, you know, at the level that you'd like to see them mature at. And this is a difficult area for it to mature. You know, it seems like it's very much a challenging one all the time. But it's one that's just highly misunderstood. You know, I'm just sitting here, you know, I'm getting ready to, you know, I'm sitting here writing the first chapter of the RSP for this year. And receivers are, you know, is the one that I'm doing right now. And it's just, you know, doing it from a level where I don't even have a team, the amount of, you know, I feel like the amount of conversation that I put in the beginning of the chapter to explain, you know, when people say, this is a great receiver class. Well, is it a great receiver class? You know, what makes a great receiver class? What, you know, what should our expectations be about things? Because, I mean, you know, we... You know, when, you know, just from the public fan media point of view, you know, people will say, this is a great class. Okay. And then I look at it and I think, well, what does that really mean? Because it could be, is it great from the standpoint of that the potential is great, that there's a lot of players who you would project that if they land with the right team, that they stay healthy, that they're, you know, focused at being professionals at their job and development, and that they can develop at a level of, you know, facility that that's a smooth acclimation, that there could be, you know, 10, 15 players who could give you contributor to, you know, immediate starter production, you know, and it, you know, and we know that most likely that number is going to be more like 4 to 6 as opposed to 15 to 17. But we're going to talk about 15 to 17 players, or as Mel Kiper, I think, said, there's 25 players that could go in the first couple of rounds of this draft in the wide receiver class. You know, I mean, that's, you know, you look at things like that and you can say, well, that's great, but, or, you know, that may make it a great class, but for the fan who's consuming that content, or the or anyone who's looking at the class, you know, you don't want to give them the expectation that there's, you know, 15 to 25 players who are going to be starters in the league. You want to give, you know, you kind of want to help them understand that there's the projection of potential that you should value, and then there's the reality of the situation. You know, the competition they're going to face, the scheme they're going to be in, the off-field component and maturity of now they're on their own having to do all this stuff, and they're going to have to hire the right people to work with them when it comes to areas to improve and address their game beyond what they're going to be able to do just in, you know, a short course of drills every few days, you know, during, you know, each week, that are just designed to kind of show you what you need to be doing well, not so much helping you get better at it, you know. So, you know, you have all these different things that are that have to be considered, and you kind of have to reconcile the projection with the reality and still be able to look at a board and say, you know, I'm still taking chances, because I looked at the numbers and it's like, you know, 24% of the first round wide receivers have had what I would call top 36 production at their position. I used fantasy scoring as a way to kind of bluntly look at that and just kind of say, you know, who are the top 36 scorers from year to year over, say, a 12-year period? And it's just this 12-year sample size, which isn't even like, you know, Dan's not even like a representative sample size for the history of the league, but you can never really get that either, because if I could look at different 12-year, you know, periods, and some 12-year periods might have Jerry Rice and Andre Reed, and, you know, and others might not have anybody like a Julio Jones, Demaryius Thomas, and DeAndre Hopkins. And can we really equalize all the players' fits within schemes to really derive the best meaning from all of this? But even just looking at it from a blunt way, though, you can see that, you know, from this past 12-year period, you know, from players who've been in the league at least 5 years, from, say, 5 to 12 years, the average number of seasons that they've produced, you know, in that range that have been in the top 36 is, you know, about four years worth out of that, you know, that time. And then the average number of, you know, seasons in the top 24 or top 12 is like less than a season. So like if a wide receiver actually even has one top 12 or top 24 season, that's a career year for most players who even qualify with having like 3 years of production within at least a 5-year career, and or in a anywhere between 5 to 12 years. So what you're looking at is a very small number of players who actually are consistent and productive, you know, if we were to be able to say that this was a representative sample for what the NFL is like, at least at this period of time, when we're talking about the, you know, the passing game being expanded over, you know, in terms of the rules softening with coverage and the way teams are spreading the field and how many receivers are being used and, you know, the way that they're being used. Even now you look at it and it's like, you know, Julio Jones, kind, you know, guys who break that pattern are guys like Julio Jones and DeSean Jackson and you know, Julian Edelman. And, you know, but what's funny is that even though maybe, you know, 24% of the wide receivers in the first round are the ones who qualify, and that's by far the highest percentage number. The ones who are actually the best, you know, and have like had the most production, almost half of them are guys who were drafted after the third round. So it's like, you know, you look at information like that, and it's a and try and reconcile all this and trying to share this with people. It's a lot of dense information and a lot of disparate information that has to be kind of presented in a compelling way, or else, you know, your eyes are just going to glaze over in the back of your head, and you're going to be thinking about what you liked about that player rather than being able to look at all the data. So it takes a lot to share that vision, and it takes a lot also for someone to be able to look critically at information. And it's not just about the science, but it's also being able to, you know, just interpret and see things in a manner that's going to be insightful.
No, there's no doubt. It's interesting because, again, I talk about you need to be able to articulate like the future, right? The future vision that you see of the player. But within that, there's a range, you know, like the bumpers on a bowling lane. Like if it ends, I'm sorry, if he lands in a different situation, I think there's a much more likely chance that a lot comes out of this player. And so I'm becoming more attracted to having a little bit of that range based on scheme fit. But also not like there's a 30% chance he's, you know, this, and up to a 70% chance he's this. Well, okay, that's too broad. Like, that doesn't help with decision-making. But if you can start to work on saying, okay, again, in these situations, I would expect this outcome. In these situations, I would expect that outcome. It starts to, I think, help create that narrative. Because I think one of the things that we want to look back on is we want to be able to use our past history in this, both what we collected and then how we interpreted it. We'd like to be able to look back and say, was I actually predicting anything? Was I actually doing this job? And so the more we can document that and be cognizant of what were the inputs, what was the process, here's the expectation, which is why I've always, you know, and I've told you this on and off air, but I've always respected your work, because you are articulating not just what you collected, but how you interpreted it to arrive at that conclusion, which allows you to do things in terms of studying yourself and working on keeping up with that. It also allows you to modify things based on trend, both in the short term and historically. Yes. Like if trends start to shift, you can modify things and say, okay, well, if I'm applying a 2020 lens to my 2013 data, it actually be refitted this way. Whereas in 2013, based on what was happening then, this is why it stood up that way. And most places, including teams, can't do that because everybody's final. Give me the final grade. Give me the final score. Come on. Get to the end. And I get that. Like, in the moment decision-making, yes, we do need some sort of number to leverage in that process. But that only works for that decision. And if you're going to go use that in the future, then we have to capture how we arrived at it. And I love the concept of an investment thesis, stealing from the way that, you know, banks do things. I'm always a big fan of taking from other industries. Anybody that has to document, here's how I arrived at this decision, is way better served at improving themselves and being more predictive in time, because they can't hide behind, well, sometimes I thought sometimes he'd do it. And, you know, I remember listening to two scouts talk before a meeting, and one of them, it was the first set of eyes and came up with a certain grade. And he was talking to the second one and asked the second scout, you know, hey, where'd you end up on him? And the second scout said, I put him in the fourth. The first scout asked, okay, well, why? And the second guy goes, well, I mean, I don't know. He's all right. And so if he does well, I can say, well, hey, I put him in the fourth round. Right. And if he doesn't do great, I can go, well, I mean, I only put him in the fourth round.
Right.
And it's never left me that moment of, then you don't really know the player, and you understood that there was a range of outcomes. And instead of working on articulating, I think this outcome is likely in this situation for these reasons, and I think this other outcome is likely in a different situation for different reasons. You know, these days I use the Patrick Mahomes was taken with the 10th overall pick that was originally owned by the Buffalo Bills. What happens if Patrick Mahomes is a Buffalo Bill? Is he exactly the same player? And everybody I've asked that question to says no, because right. there were things about Kansas City that helped him grow and maximize his tools. Not that he couldn't have been a good player in Buffalo. No one's made that argument, but people agree, seem to agree, you know, in the kind of a crowdsourcing sense, that there are things systematically in Kansas City that are optimal for a quarterback. And I understand that argument. So he came in with X skill set, but his range of outcomes was dependent on environments. I mean, Lewis Riddick, I was always talking about, like, we can assess the current standing of the player. But again, you brought up the point when you talk about Saquon Barkley. You know, if he was, he's at a program that can take what he has and then develop that in a way that, you know, Alex Kappa coming out of Humboldt State couldn't.
Right.
And so those environments change those human beings' futures in a different way. And if we can do better about how we document and analyze that information, it's got to help us change our hit rates.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, just to kind of end this is that, you know, for starters, I mean, I totally agree with you about things like good and inconsistent. And sometimes it's like, if you're going to, you know, maybe not for the NFL, because the NFL is like, get to the point and make these, summarize these in a brief way that, you know, I don't have to spend a long time reading these. But if you're doing it from a narrative standpoint, you know, I get the luxury of doing this from a narrative standpoint. You can begin by talking about inconsistent and good and bad and things like that, but you better explain what all of those things mean as you get down further into it. You better be able to explain inconsistent means he's good, you know, he does these things in these situations. Like, for instance, when he's playing off man coverage, when Brandon Ayuk is facing off man coverage, he's effective at being able to use his hands to work past a defender who tries to get his hands on him in off man as he gets to his stem. But when a defender, you know, is playing tight with him and is aggressive with using his hands first, then this is where Brandon Ayuk gets hung up repeatedly in coverage, and he may have, you know, one play or two plays per game where a defender, when a defender does this to him, that he gets free, but the rest of the reps, when a defender does this to him, he's slow off the line or completely incapacitated by those things. Like, you have to explain that in that kind of detail and even greater detail than what I just did to kind of pinpoint the cause and effect. You have to think about it as cause and effect. Why is he inconsistent? Where is he good? Where does he play well with this? And specifically, like, you got to name, like, what happens and what doesn't happen. And I think that that's important. And then there's just the idea of, you know, you talk about being able to look at the accountability and get better. What's interesting about that, though, about that accountability thing, and I don't want to go too far into this, but it is fascinating to me, because it's like, we have to think about accountability in the way of, it's not so much of whether the player was successful on the field, because there may be issues that are out of control with that. I think with the NFL, maybe that's different, where, you know, you are supposed to be able to see how healthy that player can remain, though predicting injury is a very difficult thing. I don't think that's, you know, talking with people, and, you know, who are in the medical profession, that's kind of a difficult thing to do. But at the same time, you know, predicting risk, you know, you want to be able, at the end of the day, if you can see that the player looks like the guy, like you said, looks like the guy that you described, whether it's in practice or whether it's in the preseason or whether it's for a couple of games before something happened that may not have been able to predict, you have to be able to understand where you can predict things, what things are predictable and what things are maybe out of your control. And I think that that's part of it too, where I think that can be a little problematic or an issue that still is going to be difficult in terms of how you hold people accountable for the work that they do. So, you know, I want to thank Dan for, you know, being on this this week for the RSP cast. The RSP publication will be available April 1st. You can download that at mattwaldmanrsp.com. You can learn more about where you can download that. It's available at mattwaldman.com. That's where you download it. You can find out more about it at mattwaldmanrsp.com. Thanks again, everyone, and you have a terrific week.